Hello, my name is Vicky Guth, and my favorite thing is gardening.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your regular host, Leah Jones, and welcome to the podcast, people who are new and coming to listen because of our host today, Amy Guth, or our guest, Vicky Guth. To give you a little bit of background and then let you know if you want to zip forward to the interview, I will be sharing some personal updates. This podcast is about hearing from people about their favorite things, how they found it, why it's important to them, what adventures it's taken them on. And I started it like Memorial Day 2020 as a COVID hobby, no commute, no social events. What was I going to do with my time? So I started this podcast. And we talk to people about hobbies, art, artists, music, all sorts of great things. This summer, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I've been getting chemotherapy for the last couple months. And January is my final month of chemotherapy. I'm getting very fatigued. And so I asked two friends, Amy Guth of the Unconventional with Amy Guth podcast and Shai Corman from Friday Night Movie podcast, each to take two episodes so I could be fatigued this month. And so thank you. This week we've got Amy Guth, who, like I said, you may know her from WGN Radio, seen her byline in the Tribune and all over the internet. She's also now the host of Unconventional with Amy Guth. Her podcast launched this year. She's talked to Steve Gadlin, Abbas Joffrey, and Laura Carney. She interviews people who have taken unconventional paths, who challenge conventional narratives, and who have built unconventional lives. So welcome to those of you who know Amy, or because you know Vicky. It's really fun to interview people we've known our whole lives and talk to them about things maybe you didn't know. So Amy is talking to her mom, Vicky Guth, this week about growing her own food. The personal updates I give at the top are just a little bit of now kind of a breast cancer treatment report, but I am through three of my four cycles of chemotherapy, which means I have 3 weeks left. I nap a lot more, a lot more. The steroids work off faster, the fatigue starts sooner, and it's more intense. But other than that, I'm still interested in food. I've had to obviously cut out or limit dairy, cut out real fibrous raw veggies. And when I make the right choices, I feel good. When I don't make the right choices, I at least know they're choices I've made and not a new side effect. This week, I had my second of four heart scans to make sure that the Herceptin isn't impacting my heart. And so far, my heart looks fantastic. My port did get kind of clogged up this week. So they had to give me something called Activase, which is a medicine that people get after heart attacks, after certain types of strokes. But it's also how you clean a catheter, which is what the port is. So after they did that, my port was working again. So I've been grateful for this thing, for keeping me away from an awful lot of bruises and tears, looking for someone who can get a needle into my right arm. So with that, I am going to go have some takeout brunch, then go see the Matrix movie. made a tradition of seeing Saturday matinees while I go through chemo treatment, and we pick things that have been out for 3 or 4 or 5 weeks. We pick the emptiest theater, masks on, no snacks in the theater, but it's how I take advantage of steroid Saturday. And with that, wear your mask, wash your hands, stay safe, get that booster or get that vaccine, and keep enjoying your favorite things.
Hi there, I'm Amy Guth, and I'm thrilled to be hosting Finding Favorites for my longtime friend, Leah Jones. So as a broadcaster, I've interviewed a lot of people, but today I'm interviewing somebody that I've definitely known for a long time, but that I've never really interviewed before. That's my mom, Vicky Guth. Welcome.
Hey, nice to be here.
It's kind of weird to me. I mean, Leah interviewed her mom for this podcast, and I was like, oh, that's a really brilliant idea. I've never interviewed my own mom. I mean,
I
kind of did, right? Like one time on WGN Radio, because you told the story of like me having a meltdown in a mall and screaming that I hate my underwear.
Yeah, I recall that vividly. Oh my God.
Both the event and the retelling on the radio.
Yes, it makes me cringe when I think about it, actually.
So, well, now we got to tell the story.
Oh, gosh. You were probably 2.5, 3, maybe. And we were in the largest mall in Atlanta, Georgia, Lenox Mall. And in the middle of this was this big stage, you know, where they put the Christmas tree up and they do special events and stuff like that. So you and a bunch of other little children were running around, and all of a sudden you stopped and just screamed at the top of your lungs, I hate my underwear. And, you know, there was a lot of benches around and all these grandmothers and grandfathers and young mothers and old mothers were all sitting around, and all eyes. I was absolutely mortified. I wanted to just get up and leave and just leave you there, you know. But I figured, well, I better take my kid with me. So I just went and kind of scooped you up and put you under my arm, and we exited the mall. That was really embarrassing.
But what I remember is that I feel like you had dressed me in something really ruffly that involved like bloomers or something, and I was like not having it.
Oh, that's probably true. I can't remember what you had on. I just blocked as much of that event out of my mind as I could. But yeah, I probably did have, you probably did have something pink on, because you never were a pink person.
No.
And, you know, girly and all that and frilly and whatever. And you probably just really hated it.
I kind of remember there was like some ruffly bloomers that like matched this dress that had to go under the dress.
Oh, that's highly possible.
And they had like ruffly things around the legs, and that was
lacy stuff on the rear. And yeah.
And it was like lace on the butt and then these little ruffles around the legs, and they were bothering me. And I was just like, I hate this. Get rid of this crap. I don't want this.
Oh, gosh.
Well, I'm real sorry for mortifying you.
Well, I'm sorry I dressed you in that kind of stuff. I hope those things have gone out of style now.
I mean, I think like for the toddlers and tiaras crowd, it's still a thing, but.
Well, yeah, there's that.
I don't think so much. I don't think people are taking their
podcast right there.
Yeah, that's a whole other podcast. I don't think people are like taking their kids to the mall in the bloomers anymore. At least I hope not. If you are, check in with your kids. See if the bloomers are driving her nuts, because
really
she might.
See if they really like having that on before you let them parade around in the middle of the largest mall in Atlanta.
And scream that they hate their underwear.
Oh, Lord. That's a pretty bad day right
so,
there.
I mean, now that would have gone viral. And if social media existed then, that would have gone viral. God. And we could sell the NFT and make millions.
And we would have had a website. I hate my underwear.
I bet you ihatemyunderwear.com is available. if it's not available, well, I don't know. I don't want to know what's on it. It's probably like porn or something.
Oh, Lord, that's funny. That is funny.
Good
oh
times. God. Well, nothing like opening with a story that is roundly embarrassing.
Underwear story. Oh, my God.
Outspoken from a young age, little Amy Guth. That's what.
You know what? We should have known what was coming right then and there. Yeah. Right then and there.
I'm going to communicate my needs very boldly to all involved. I'm empowered to do so.
Oh, God.
Okay, well, before we dive into your favorite thing that we're here to talk about, I want to talk about the work that you do.
Yes.
And so you and Dad have a custom woodworking operation, but I don't think I know about the how and the why of how it got underway. I just know that that's like Dad's always done woodworking stuff. We've always had like, he's always had his shop wherever we've lived, but I don't really know how it became an official business for you guys.
It probably started when we moved to South Florida and got into boating. We were big boaters when we were down there, and we started noticing all the names on boats, you know, on the fantail and then on the stern and port of the boats. And everyone you would read, you go, gosh, I wonder what's the story behind that? Because there was one that we always saw when we were leaving our house and going out to the Gulf. There was one called Done Shivering. And we had figured it was somebody that had moved down from the north and gone to Florida, and they were done with the cold. But every boat, I feel like, has a story behind its name. And every quarter board has a story. So I think that would make an interesting book one day, by the way. But so it probably started then. And so when we got one boat and Dad decided he was going to make a quarter board for it.
Which is, for people who don't know, which is like, that's the name of it. Like that's the...
That is the name. And it's called a quarter board because it's usually mounted on the first quarter of the boat from the bow to the end of the first quarter. And there's usually a little cabin and you mount your name on it. And it's on the port side and the starboard side and usually on the fantail as well. And that's how quarter boards got their name. So we made one by hand, which turned out to be really laborious and a little dangerous because those tools are very, very sharp. So that's probably where it all started taking root in there. And then we moved to the mountain here and had a boat for a while. And Dad decided to retire, but he knew that he needed something to do. And I knew he needed something to do after he retired. So he started, I think he was just, kind of thinking about it. And this little seed had been planted. And one day he said, well, I bought something. And I went, oh, okay. A gallon of milk. What did you buy? Well, I bought this really expensive machine called a CNC router. And I was like, I don't know what that is. So he started telling me about it. And that's where he starts. And this is what we can do with it. It carves, you build this picture on the computer. Take your flash drive out to the machine, plug it in, and it spits out this gorgeous picture on wood. So that's kind of where it all started. And it's something that we do together. We do our things separately, but yet we do it as a project we work on together. Yeah, we really enjoy it. We have had times when I have had quarter boards literally laying all over the place. My dining table is actually not a dining table. It is a holder for quarter boards, and that's okay.
So Dad does the carving part and you usually paint them and kind of fancy them up. I feel like they usually have you make them pretty because they usually have like gold letters. And sometimes you've had some like really cool designs that I've seen you do on Instagram and stuff like that.
Yeah, we started out and we've actually gone back and looked at what we did early on and how we have progressed in our skills, I guess you could say. And we started out with just putting names on a board and then we've actually done a lot of signs, just basic signs, address signs you can put up in your yard or, just odd kind of stuff, not just quarter boards. And our skills have developed so much over the last 3 or 4 years that we've gotten really particular about we don't let any board go before it's perfect. Even if we have to stop and do it all over, it's not going to leave until it's perfect. And that's probably the OCD in me coming out. But anyway, it's fun. It keeps us both busy. Yeah.
What would you say is the most challenging part of running a small business?
Probably for us, because we're older and we don't do social media as much as we could. And because I'm kind of not very skilled in that, I guess you could say, is finding and connecting with clients. Once we connect with clients, we've got one client that we've done, I don't know how many signs we've done for her. Once we connect, we're great, but it's getting the word out and letting people know this is what we do. We work with a nonprofit up here on the mountain called Quarter Boards for a Cause. And a portion of the proceeds go to our local first responders up here. And the goal is to get every house with a name on it. So we got a long way to go. We have a long way to go with that one.
So people can go to quarterboards.com.
Yes.
And find out, and you can make like a custom order from there.
Everything we do is custom. And Bob likes to connect with people. He just picks up the phone and talks to them and he gets to know everybody, And we had one just recently that decided he wanted a certain finish on it, but we knew it would look great with this other finish, a little more glossy, a little shinier. And so we finally convinced him, thank goodness. And it turned out beautifully. But I think Dad's thing is connecting with the people and getting to know the people. But then he gets it to me and makes it pretty so I can make it pretty.
We got to get you guys on Etsy. I mean, that's been like...
We actually just reopened. We had an Etsy account for a while and we closed it down because Dad got frustrated. But we just got it back up.
Good. That's where you need to be.
Yeah.
Because that's where people go for that kind of stuff. That's like the modern craft fair.
Yeah, like a craft mall.
Yeah. All right. In the meantime, though, folks, quarterboards.com is the place.
Quarterboards.com. Yes.
What would you say is the pie in the sky, the dream project, the coolest thing you could imagine getting through, like a custom order?
Well, we actually did one for a Coast Guard ship that was actually pretty cool.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. It was called Hauser, and it was huge. It was just this huge board. I mean, just tremendous, because you can imagine a Coast Guard ship, they're big. And we did two of them. And I don't know, getting on a celebrity boat, some celebrity contacting us and saying, hey, I got a boat and I need a quarter board. That would be awesome.
Okay, put it out there in the universe. It's out there now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, some random celebrity with a boat. I need you to order a sign from my folks.
There you go.
I need you to get your quarter board. Whatever weird thing your boat is called, they will do it.
Yep.
You can speak freely to them, even if it's got like a raunchy name, it's fine.
Yes.
It's totally fine.
We do just about everything. There are probably a few limits on things we would put out there, but yeah, whatever your little heart desires, we can do that.
I feel like we've put it on the universe now. So we're going to find a celebrity that has a boat that needs a quarter board.
Yes, that would be awesome.
I'm going to laugh if like, a Kardashian retweets this or something. Like,
wow, that would be crazy. Oh my gosh.
Right. I mean, that's stranger things have happened when people put things out on a podcast, people listen and go, oh, well, my second cousin is Kanye or, you know, who knows, like weirder things have happened. All right. Well, what is it that we are here to talk about today with in terms of finding favorites, your favorite thing?
I do a lot of stuff. You know, I sew, I quilt, I do all that kind of stuff. I love to cook. I love to make soup, as you well know. But my very, very, very favorite thing to do is gardening. I love to get my hands dirty. I love to be dirty out in the yard. The dirtier, the better, usually. If I can be outside, I am a happy duck. The world is a good place when I'm outside dirty.
I don't remember a time that you weren't gardening. Everywhere we've lived, you've always had plants going, even when we didn't have like a yard per se, like we had little windowsill plants, and you gave me like the little African violet when I was a kid and I named him Brian. Oh, God. Do you remember Brian, the African violet?
I remember Brian.
I remember you saying, like, you were trying to explain to me, because I was pretty little. I remember you saying, African violets are very sensitive. You got to be gentle with them. You're trying to explain, like, the leaves are kind of like succulents. Yeah. And so I took that to mean, like, Brian was sensitive. And so I remember going, like, good job today being a plant, Brian. You're doing good. I don't know why I called him Brian.
Oh, God, so funny. I do not remember Brian. Oh, my God.
I clearly remember Brian, the African violet. So what was your kind of first foray into gardening?
When I was a kid, we grew up basically in the country in North Louisiana. And my mom was an avid gardener then. And we also had this enormous vegetable garden that we would get to help. Well, actually, we wouldn't get to help. We were told to help. And I think that's where everything probably started taking root, no pun intended. My dad was a grower, you know, and all my relatives up there were farmers. So, you know, there's probably a gene somewhere for all that. But I remember my mother being that nurturer, you know, planting something, watching it grow. And so that's probably where I get a lot of mine from. You know, and growing up, everywhere that we moved, you know, we always had a garden. I mean, everywhere. My mother was the nurturer, you know, and she always loved pretty flowers. And when I was growing up, one of our neighbors had daylilies and iris that I would just wander through and just marvel at, because every one of them was different. And because there's so many varieties. And so this neighbor, Jamie, was always giving us plants from her yard, giving them to my mom, and they were swapping stuff. But I think that's where my first seeds were planted when I was real little. And I still love daylilies and iris too. They're also pretty easy to grow, which is very helpful. But as you know, when you were a kid, I didn't have a lot of time to garden, but I tried to have something, house plants, something. It's just something that I love to watch. I love to watch them change, watch them grow, take care of them, help them on their way. And now that when we moved to South Florida, I had the time to really get into it. And in Florida, South Florida especially, if you plant it, it's going to grow. I mean, South Florida is really easy to garden in. And when we lived there, you know, I just had plants and stuff everywhere. And then when we moved up here to the mountain, everything was so different. Totally different weather, soil, vegetation, everything was so different. And so I decided to go through a Master Gardener class here. And it's something I had wanted to do for a long time, but just didn't have the time. So finally I went through it and it was one of the best things I've ever done. Great group of people. And I guess my contribution to Master Gardeners is through the Chattanooga Zoo here. We go down and we have several gardens that we've created at the zoo that we maintain. And we work with the zoo, you know, in trying to make it a pretty place that people can enjoy, not just the animals, but for the gardens as well. So that's what I love to do more than anything. And then here at the house, when we bought our house, it was a long gray boxcar. It was just it had no curb appeal, nothing, had a little stoop on it. So we can't leave anything alone. So we put a big porch on it. But then I had to lay out a landscape that was interesting because this house had sat with no landscape for 70 years. It was built in 1952 and it had absolutely no landscape on it. And so that was a really big challenge for me. And I didn't really know exactly where to start. But one day I was working on a quilt and I pulled out this piece of fabric that I've always loved so much. And it had these on a kind of a creamy white background. It had this green and dark red and purple and pink. And I thought those are going to be the colors of my garden because we painted our house kind of a Florida green. And everybody knows our house as, oh, the greenhouse. Because there's no other colors. There's no other houses up here like this. But my landscape, I wanted it to complement that color because there's certain colors that just don't look good with it. Like orange would not look good with that color. So I pulled this piece of fabric out and those became the colors of my landscape. And it's worked out really, really well. I've had to tweak some things. Not everything has been successful, but for the most part, it's been successful. This makes me feel good.
Yeah, it's a pretty yard. And also you were like stone cold badass about it because there were times when you were working on that yard that I would be like, hey, what are you doing? And you're just like texting me pictures of like, I'm moving boulders across the yard. I'm like, what are you doing? Hire somebody to help you.
Yeah, well, I'm probably going to have to hire some because I have some really, really big rocks now that I need to move that I cannot handle. There was no landscape. There was no curb appeal to this house. And no, there was a sidewalk, but it was really broken and old. And so we kind of created that. And I had gotten a load of stone because I wanted a stone border on it. So I had to move all these boulders. And that's probably what's wrong with my back to this day.
I mean, we're not talking about little rocks. Like these were dog sized. They were big.
These are, yes, bigger than a chihuahua for sure. And then when we tore the back step off, whoever had built this house had built that step so well. It was not supposed to go anywhere ever. But that step had so many, I mean, and these are huge things. They're like not car size, but they are huge boulders. And yeah, somebody's going to have to come move those for me because I can't do that.
I feel like you grow a lot of flowers and stuff, but also a lot of food. Always have grown like tomatoes and stuff like that. I think a lot about the food system and kind of where we're at with that and how we treat farmers. And I know that's something on your mind. I wonder if you could kind of talk about that a bit.
Part of my Master Gardener training was learning about proper use of pesticides and this kind of thing. And it got me thinking a lot about how we are treating our soil. And I came up with this theory that if, you know, we have this conventionally grown food, and then we have our organic food. Unless you know the complete history of a plot of land, you can't really claim it's totally organic unless you know its true history, because you don't know what that farmer 35 years ago was putting on your land.
In terms of like forever chemicals and things like that.
Forever chemicals, because some of that stuff stays in the ground forever and ever and ever. So I feel like we have to be really, really careful. And when we grow our own, we can be careful. You know, I don't put anything out on my garden that's poisonous. I just don't use it. I found some other ways around that, you know, with beneficial insects and with essential oils. You can do wonders with that stuff. So I think we just have to be really, really mindful of that because, you know, you really are what you eat. And when you eat this stuff, it's going to stay in your body for a while and it's going to mess your body up. So for me, I like to know what I'm putting in my mouth, in my body. And so I know that I can go out and pull my kale and I know that nothing chemical has been on it. And my brothers and two nieces and I have also inherited a farm in North Louisiana that has opened up an entirely new world for us. We have a wonderful, fabulous cousin who farms it for us, thank heaven, and he knows what he's doing. But it's a wonderful piece of property that is very, very fertile. It was when the Great Mississippi River flooded back in 1939.
Oh, that was 26.
26.
Is we'll 26? Have to do a little fact check here.
Oh, it was 26 because my mother was a baby. That's right. The Mississippi River, and it brought all this silt and all this wonderful stuff all this way into North Louisiana. And so this piece of property is fantastic. It grows so well.
1927. Sorry, I just looked it up.
Yes.
Okay. But it grows so well because of everything that came up that flood.
Everything that flood brought in deposited all those wonderful sediments into this area. And it's wonderful soil. It's just great.
And so by taking, like knowing what you know about planting and growing and healthy choices with soil, how has that informed what you do with that piece of farm property?
Well, you know, since our cousin is farming it, you know, he has his way of doing it. And that's the way he's always done it. We can suggest things and we can ask questions and he is free to ignore it. That's fine. Because he's the one doing all the work. But I know that when my grandparents lived there, they had a huge vegetable garden that they probably put, you know, like seven dust or something on because that was what was available then. But it's still a beautiful piece of property. And if I lived there, well, I wouldn't because there's too many rattlesnakes there. But if I lived there, I'd have to have the soil tested and see what all's in it.
So it's not like you can really, I mean, yeah, I agree. The organic thing is tricky, right? Because it's like with very good intentions, someone goes and gets like an organic certification, but we can't do anything about what happened years before, nor can you do anything about what's up the hill from you when it rains and there's groundwater.
And what your neighbor is doing in the next field, you know, because you've got drift from, you know, the air is going to bring stuff in, the groundwater is going to come through. So, you know, you're very limited in what you can do, but you can learn about it.
And I think it's good to like support organic farmers who are trying to do it the right way.
I do too. And their intentions are honorable, I think. But yeah, you know, we can't change what happened 50 years ago. I remember when I was a kid growing up, behind our house was usually a cornfield. They would grow something back there. And my mother, when we would be at home during the summer, all of a sudden she'd yell, "Shut the windows, shut the windows. I hear the plane." And the plane, a crop duster, was coming to spray that field, probably with DDT. But my mom would say, we'd have to run around the house like crazy people, shut all the windows, trying to keep the drift out of the house because you could see it coming at you. But, you know, that's what they did. That's what they did.
Did you ever watch that movie Food, Inc.?
I don't know.
Oh, man, it'll get you mad.
Oh, I'm sure it would.
Oh, I mean, like in a good productive way, it's really interesting because it's really kind of speaking to what factory farming did to the American family farms. And like they trace products in the supermarket that look like they're, you know, thousands of different products, like so many of them can be traced to just a few companies or a few manufacturers, especially like the power that McDonald's and Simplot potatoes have over all the potatoes in the United States and our export of potatoes. It's really fascinating, but it'll super piss you off. Well,
great.
I can already imagine all that you will say about that movie because you will be like, hell no.
It probably make my blood pressure go up.
Oh, it for sure will because it's really infuriating. And there's a lot in there about the way that animals are treated. Like there's a whole thing in there about Tyson and Purdue chicken farmers. One woman who like loses her contract because she has like an open coop where they get sunlight and they put pressure on her to have this closed thing where the chickens like can barely even turn around and they collapse under their own weight. And it's this whole thing. And you just like leave it going like, oh, we're doomed. People are the worst. We have ruined all of this.
Well, and yes, we have a chicken plant here in downtown Chattanooga. And there are days when you have to hold your breath driving through there. It is so bad. Rumor has it they're going to move them out, but it hadn't happened yet. Well, but it is disgusting.
But it would be good if like, you know, we could just, I mean, I try to like when I buy eggs or something, I'll try to buy, I look for like pasture raised, grain fed instead of, because they get in this movie, they get into like all the chicken byproduct that's fed to chickens and like and how corn is so heavily subsidized. So we put corn in like everything. I think you will like the movie in the most angry way.
Well, and your dad and I just had this conversation about preservatives in dog food. We have the two dogs. And so I had just bought a new kind of dog food. And so we go in there and we're starting to read the ingredients, and it's not horrible stuff in there. There's a lot of fortified vitamin kind of stuff. But then, you know, there's a couple of things in there that are preservatives that are probably not great for dogs.
Don't know. Or anybody.
Well, for anybody. Yeah. Yeah. Actually.
I want to back up to something you were talking about with your own garden that I thought was interesting. You kind of mentioned companion planting and essential oils instead of using pesticides.
Yes.
And you introduced me to the idea of companion planting. Basically, the shortest possible version of that is marigolds are always a good idea to plant with your stuff.
They are.
But it's really kind of, I mean, it's a really complicated thing if you want to plot out a garden or just put more than one thing in a pot, of knowing what goes with this. Because some plants will put chemicals into the soil just by living.
Right.
That will be damaging to other plants.
Right.
And some will help them and become really beneficial, or help like repel a natural pest. And I think that's fascinating and so under-discussed.
It is fascinating. And I wish more people would do that. It takes a little research. You know, you can't, like you say, you can't just put two things together, because they may be mortal enemies. Who knows? But a long time ago, I found this book called Tomatoes Love Roses, or Roses Love Tomatoes, or something like that. And that was kind of my introduction to companion planting. And thinking back on my childhood, my mom would plant flowers interspersed within our vegetable garden. And I just thought she was doing it because, you know, whatever. But I think that was probably something that she had learned from her parents and maybe her grandparents. You know, they were bringing that information forward. And we do not do that enough. We should, because it would eliminate a lot of this chemical stuff. I always put marigolds out. They're not my favorite flower, but I put them out anyway. And I'm learning about nasturtiums. They put a lot of nitrogen into the soil, and, you know, just stuff like that. And it's real simple stuff. Once you know it, it's like, oh gosh, why didn't I think of that?
What are some common combinations that are very good and very bad?
Oh gosh, I'd have to get my book out now.
It's generally like what goes with that as a food, right? Like tomatoes and onions.
Yeah. And I found something out. I had planted some fennel in one of my raised beds, and I had a big tomato that I put close to it. And then I was reading something, of course, after, you know, like 6 weeks or so, this tomato wasn't doing really well. I thought, what's going on with that? And I read that fennel will actually inhibit the growth of a tomato. And I thought, well, great. So now my fennel is still growing, by the way. But next year I'll put the tomato somewhere else. I'll find some, I don't know what's going to go with fennel.
But it is a rabbit hole. Like once you got my head into that idea, then it's hard not to just start digging through it, and you find all these weird plants. You're like, oh, this random herb will put this really beneficial thing into the soil next to this tomato or next to this pepper or whatever. And if you don't do it, you're like, it'll grow, but it might kind of suck as a plant. But then the one that's planted next to this beneficial thing will just thrive and be this huge, beautiful plant.
I tried a couple of different gardening methods this year. One was, I've always had a lot of containers because our topsoil here on the mountain is about 2 inches thick because we're on top of this rock. And so a lot of my stuff has to be in containers. So I've had horse troughs as containers, and my tomatoes do really well in those. This year, my lettuce just, it didn't do anything in there. So this year I tried a method of planting that came from Europe, and I think it was either German or French, and I can't remember the name of it because it's like as long as my arm. And I built my raised beds in, and then I went over to our local city works and got logs, you know, not really huge logs, but, you know, like 6 or 7 inches, and started putting those in there. And then I put some leaves in there with them. And then I started with little smaller branches, and then little twigs and more leaves and more compost. And those beds have done exceptional this year.
So the logs are like the base of it.
The logs are like the base of it. And over time, these logs and all these leaves and all these twigs are going to start decomposing and give out all this beneficial stuff to the soil. And so every year I'm going to have to turn this and maybe dig it out a little bit and put another couple of logs in it, because fortunately they're not too deep. And those beds have been really, really, my tomatoes, I had to get a ladder to harvest some of my tomatoes and build a frame for them because they got so big. I won't do that next year. I'll trim them back. But they have done exceptionally well. So I'm going to have to build. So we're going to put two more beds in, I think, and I'll do that method too.
You mentioned essential oils. What essential oils do you put on plants?
There was a company that I ran across. It was called Dr. Earth. And I had aphids on my roses out front, and I didn't want to put stuff on them. And so I found these products from them, and they were basically essential oils just mixed together. They smelled very earthy. They didn't smell like, you know, a chemical cesspool. And I sprayed it on my aphids and never had aphids again. It was wonderful. So again, you'd have to do a little homework to see what works. And it's usually a combination of stuff like cinnamon oil and lavender, which I try to plant lavender anyway. Rosemary oil. It's just a combination of stuff that you can mix together. And I've had really good success with it. I know some people have not had, but I really like it. It makes your yard smell good too. My next challenge is going to be how to control moles and voles and chipmunks, because we have them in abundance up here. And I had read that moles and voles, you know, they make those tunnels and just ruin your yard. I had read that they don't like strong smells. So I empty out my K cups and clean them out so I can recycle them. And I take my coffee grounds and I put them down in all these mole holes. I'll just pack it in there. And the next thing I know.
So you're caffeinating the moles is what you're doing.
I am. I'm revving the chipmunks up is what I'm doing. They're on caffeine highs. And so, and I now have gone out and the chipmunk holes are just busted wide open again. So they probably were caffeinated. But then I read, well, a tea of garlic and cloves. You put the garlic and cloves together with water and let it sit there and make this tea. And you can spray that out. So I didn't have time to do that. So I just went out and bought a bunch of garlic in bulk and just stuck cloves of garlic down in all these holes. Everything smelled really good. But I still have moles and voles. So I have not conquered those little boogers yet. And the chipmunks are still running crazy. So I don't know what I'm going to do about those, because they're really detrimental to your soil. My backyard looked like I had a tiller run through it. There were so many mole holes in it, or tunnels rather. So I don't know what I'm going to do about them.
But I feel like a lesser person would have just been like, you know, the obvious thing and gone, okay, what kills them? Like, what chemical can I put all over them and just kill them? But this idea is like, just make your yard not appealing to them.
They can go to my neighbor's yards.
Dig up somewhere else.
Yeah, dig somewhere else. But well, and I didn't want to, they've also been in the front yard. I have a big fig tree out there and all my landscape stuff. And, you know, the moles and voles, you can walk over my yard. It feels like a sponge. It's just terrible in spring. And I didn't want to put anything out because a lot of people let their dogs and cats run up here. And I didn't want to be responsible for, you know, making somebody's pet sick. So I didn't want to put anything out. So that's the biggest challenge I have right now, trying to control the moles and voles, because they're driving me crazy. The dogs kind of chase the chipmunks and, you know, they play their little chipmunk chasing game. But yeah.
So let me ask you this. I feel like a lot of people have really quick judgments about their planting skills. I feel like a lot of people see my plants on my Instagram and go, oh, how do you grow plants in the city? And I don't have a green thumb. I have a black thumb. I kill all the plants. My theory is that people that kill plants are paying too much attention to them. I think people like overwater them is usually what's going on.
Usually, yes.
Some of my friends have brought me plants and gone, what did I do? And I look at it, I'm like, your soil is basically mud. But when people say like, where do I start? Like I kill plants. I don't know how to deal with plants. Like where's a good place for them to just start getting into gardening?
Get you a little indoor plant, like something, you know, that suits the light in your house, like a little philodendron, you know, or something real easy.
Like the snake plant?
Yeah, the snake plant, a mother-in-law's tongue, iron tongue, or whatever that iron plant. I don't think you can kill that. In your landscape, if you want to grow mondo grass, you cannot kill mondo grass. I have tried. I have a lot of it, and it's not my favorite plant, but it came with the house, so you know, I'm kind of stuck with it. But I have purposely tried to kill it, and it just doesn't die ever. I find roses to be really easy. Roses have been, there's so many cultivars out there now that are disease resistant, pest resistant. Roses are actually, I think they're really easy and they're beautiful. You get this beautiful reward from it.
And there's so many kinds of roses. I love looking at all the fun names. I want a rose named after me at some point in my life.
Oh, we can do that.
I think you can do that. I mean, there's so many cool ones. The Barbra Streisand rose is very beautiful, not just because I love Babs, but it's like a very beautiful purple rose. It's very, very pretty. But there's lots of neat stories of, because there's so many thousands of cultivars, there's so many interesting stories, especially like in the 20s and 30s. I feel like it was a very chic thing to like honor people with rose names. And so there's all kind of weird roses. And I love to like walk around and try to figure out which one it, what they are as I see them.
Yeah, they, you know, back then they were having to cultivate all these things and breed, so to speak, all these new roses. And they were hard to grow. I mean, they were not the roses that we have today, for sure. They took a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of determination to grow them. But today they have made growing roses so much easier. There was a plant that we had in South Florida. It looked like gigantic mondo grass, and it was called flax lily. It is the easiest thing to grow if you live in South Florida, and it puts on this beautiful bloom and it makes this beautiful show in your yard. So if you live in South Florida where it's hot, grow flax lily. It's beautiful.
Also, I feel like people a lot of times will just buy like the obvious, like the very widespread plants, like go to Home Depot and buy a little tomato and maybe like a basil or a mint. And I think another thing people do is they put them in the wrong pots. Like I have a neighbor, I see her balcony, and she would put plants in pots that didn't have drainage. And I would just see those plants sitting there just turning yellow and dying. And I was like, I just want to drill a hole in these pots because I could see you're overwatering your plants. I think that's kind of part of it. But then you also have to take into account like the zones, which are changing, we just saw like the Pacific Northwest had record summer heat and a lot of snow before Chicago got snow. So like they're changing indeed. So we're going to probably be growing different things. But I think the whole native plant movement is a really interesting one, just for the pollinator's sake.
Oh, yeah. And we have a native plant society here. It's called Wild Ones. And we have an urban farm here. It's called Crabtree Farms. That is where I try to get all my plants from, because everything they do there is organic. You know, they use worm castings as fertilizer, and they're growing their own worms. I mean, it's a very sustainable farm. And so they have a big plant sale a couple times a year. And that's where I try to get all my plants from. And they have like, there are just so many varieties of tomatoes, for instance, and they try to grow as many as they can for the seedlings. And so sometimes it's just fun to go out and get a new tomato that you've never grown before, and to discover a new one. But that's a fun place to go to in the spring. But they have a lot of native stuff too. You know, a lot of native berries. They'll have elderberries and different varieties of blueberries and blackberries and just all kind of stuff. It's just that they have such a wide variety of stuff, as well as some trees too. They'll have some little saplings that you can get too. It's just in the springtime, as a gardener, it's really hard not to just buy one of everything, because you want that variety, but yet you have to put some restraint. And I know what I can put in. I've had some failures. I know they're not going to work, but discovering new stuff too is fun.
I love the that Seed Savers catalog, because they have all kind of cool.
Yeah, that one. And what is it? Baker Creek.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
There are all these cool heirloom seeds that don't exist anymore.
The heirloom seed. And those are hard to find sometimes.
And so do you generally start things from seed, or do you buy plants?
It depends on what it is. You know, lettuce and stuff, I just throw it in the soil. But for tomato, because I don't have a lot of room to do that, and I don't have good light, I just don't have anywhere to do that kind of stuff. So
for like seedlings.
Yeah, to grow my own seedlings. So I usually had to buy stuff, which is fine.
I'm going to ask you to kind of look at the tea leaves a little bit here. Like, and I realize this is like asking you to speculate on behalf of all of a huge thing. But when you look at the future of agriculture, you know, I feel like it's gotten so commercial, and there's, you know, a lot of, you know, at the grocery store, it might say natural, but like natural doesn't really mean anything. And then the considerations you brought up about organic, things like that, it's increasingly difficult. But I think consumers are getting more and more aware of like what's in my food and why should it be this hard to know what's in my food and where it came from? So what do you think kind of the future when we look at agriculture, but also gardening? Like, do you think more people are going to start moving towards gardening? Do you think, you know, we're going to go back to a time where everybody had a garden? Like, what's your kind of feeling about where we're headed with agriculture and home gardening?
When COVID hit, there was a big resurgence in gardening, especially growing your own food. And we have seen in our master gardeners that we have two classes a year and they fill up, I mean, just overnight. Because, and it's a lot of it is really young people wanting to know how to grow their own food. I personally think that should be taught in school. Everybody needs to know how to grow their own food. But it's really interesting to see how there has been this growing interest in growing your own food. And I think part of that is because we have access to information now. You know, we can dig around and we can find out all kinds of stuff about companies and products. And we don't like what we're reading. We want to treat ourselves better, and we want to treat our world better as well. And so I think people are just becoming so aware of treating ourselves better and our world better. And it's reflected in the number of people that have shown this interest in growing their own food. And I think it's great. I think it's wonderful that we can, especially younger people, are showing such an interest in doing this.
So you mentioned that, you know, this has always been part of your life. Like for as long as you can remember, there was gardening and farming was part of it. So what advice would you have to somebody who maybe has young kids who wants to instill good gardening habits in them? I mean, you've taught little kids before and you've done programs for them about gardening. And I remember you saying that they take to this idea of environmental stewardship pretty easily.
I do.
It's a pretty good place to start. So for parents listening, where could they start building these habits for their kids now?
Our Master Gardener program has a summer camp that's open for 5 to 12 young kids, elementary school kids. That fills up immediately. But again, I think people like me, master gardeners or just dedicated gardeners, can help our children by getting into the schools, getting schools involved, teaching kids how to grow their own food, teaching kids the joy of watching a seed grow. And they love it. That's the thing. They just absolutely love it. They gravitate toward that wonder of watching something grow. And you know, it's not hard to get them engaged. If they know they're going to get their hands dirty, they love it even more. When I've done tours out at the farm, when we get to the worm castings and we start talking about worm poop and stuff like that, you know, I think it's hysterical, you know, and it's stuff like that. Getting that spark going and getting them to ask those questions, you know, and then taking that information home to mom and saying, "Mom, we talked about worm poop all day. What about?" And then they can tell their mom about the worm poop, you know, and maybe mom will get interested in growing a tomato plant. You know, I think if you have a pot, you can grow something in it and make it a discovery, you know, make it interesting and get them to keep a journal on it and measure it every day, you know, just something to give them a little ownership in this plant and get that wonder going, that curiosity, because it's easy to do.
Or tell them that their African violet is really sensitive. And this little kid will be like, "My plant's going to get his feelings hurt. He's really sensitive. I need to be nice to him."
Yeah, well, I talk to my plants all the time. I know Dad thinks I'm crazy, but I do. I talk to my plants. I talk to my plants out in the yard. My neighbors probably think I'm nuts, but you know.
Yeah, let them.
I know. I'm beyond caring, so whatever.
We've covered a lot of garden stuff. What have I not asked you about that you think is important to bring up about gardening?
That's a hard question.
We haven't really talked about compost.
I am a big composter. I compost all of my kitchen scraps, everything. And as a matter of fact, you gave me a composter.
Yeah.
It's a turning composter.
It's like a drum thing.
It's a drum. Thank you. That word. I have had to... The one drawback of that is that it's not on the ground. And so you lose some of the beneficial insects that come up out of the ground. So sometimes I have to add some bacteria to it to, you know, really get it cooking. But it's been pretty good. It's for me and my small space that I have here, and the fact that I have large dogs that would get into my compost pile, and the raccoons and the possums and everything else, it's a good alternative. And I use my compost all the time. And that's what I use as fertilizer. I don't put out any, I do have some commercial fertilizer, but it's organic. It's got fish emulsion in it and it stinks. And then my dogs come along and try to eat it because they love fish. But that's the only fertilizers I use, and knock on wood, so far, but so far so good.
Yeah. I think it'd be interesting to see your take on how it all works here. I mean, here in Chicago, I don't think about it being like this big garden ecosystem, but there are plots of land that like developers went bust on, things like that, that have been divided into these little beds, and you rent them, and people get on a very long waiting list. I've been on a couple. I've yet to get a plot, but you have this little garden. I think they're usually like maybe 2 or 3 feet by 6 or 8 feet. They're pretty small, but it covers this lot, and it's suddenly this really beautiful garden. And sometimes they'll put like native plants around the outside to bring the pollinators in and things like that. But it's really kind of cool to see how people make use of their space. But one thing that I've been seeing more of here in the city that I'm excited about, because a lot of landlords even will say in your lease, you cannot do even porch compost because they are afraid of rats and bugs.
Oh, well, there's that.
So like they'll say you can't do it, but more compost services are springing up.
Yes.
You like, they give you this special sealed bucket and you leave it out and they'll come by and pick it up and drop a fresh bucket of either empty or soil or whatever. And you can, you know, do that way, which I think more of that would go a very long way, because I think we're so disconnected from our food system and our natural world, right? Like the built environment and the natural environment. We have for so long, I feel like we've sat on top of it, like we're the humans and we're in charge and we can build whatever we want,
right?
Without thinking about our impact on the natural world. And I think that more and more time is running out to do that, and we have to pay attention to our world.
Well, and I think right now more and more people are starting to do that.
Yeah.
At least I hope they are, because, you know, the extreme weathers that we've had, and especially the last couple of years, maybe we've all just been paying attention more. But, you know, Colorado, just two towns just burned in Colorado and people lost everything just like, you know, a couple of days ago. And we just need to do a better job. We need to be better stewards of whatever little plot of land we have, just be a better steward. And that's kind of how I look at my yard. I need to take care of this little plot, my little almost half acre, and make sure I'm doing the best I can with it.
That feels like a good mic drop right there. That feels like a good place to end. Well, thank you. I appreciate you being a good sport and hopping on for this podcast.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.